Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review was heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on biodiesel and alternative fuels right after this message. Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime and what you should say to police or investigators and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct a discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements, 28 things that you need to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure. Rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. Now, after Rule 1 is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. I got a letter in here from a listener. He said, I just finished listening to your show on renewable energy. And when I was young in southern Minnesota, a lot of farmers had wind generators to furnish electricity before the REA came in with cheap power. The generators were 32 volts, but they furnished enough power to farm. Then in the 1960s, farmers were starting to use alcohol in their tractors produced from the crops grown on the farm. Soon all the tractors came out with diesel engines that made alcohol out, or put alcohol out. Then in the 1970s, I was at a demonstration in North Dakota on a machine that cold-pressed sunflower oil. This oil was filtered, and with no other processing, it was ran in a farm tractor under heavy use with only 5% loss of power. It was estimated that 10 acres grew enough fuel to run about a 500-acre farm. The machine was made in Japan, but it was outlawed in the United States. Now, the machine was made in Japan and outlawed in the United States, this listener reports. Now, it said that the oil was to be refined, or has to be refined. I think our politicians are lining their pockets. Well, let's get into this thing of biodiesel. Last time I reported to you some of the pertinent facts, and I connected it with ethanol. Ethanol is another government program, which is, on the surface, designed to help farmers. And after all, don't we all want to help the farmers? But is it really designed to help the farmers, or is it claimed for the purposes of public relations to help farmers, but its real purpose is to help the big multinational corporations like Archer Daniels Midland? Notice this listener says, it was estimated that 10 acres would grow enough to run a 500-acre farm. The machine was made in Japan and outlawed in the United States. Why would the United States outlaw such a wonderful machine? Think about it. We have a lot of farmers. It wouldn't take much to put in 10 acres of sunflowers. And then if you could get all of the fuel that you need to run your 500-acre farm off of 10 acres of sunflowers, think of it. The farmer could use this and he wouldn't have to buy diesel. He wouldn't have to pay tax. Instead of paying $2 a gallon for diesel, why, he would be paying $2 a gallon for sunflower oil. But then the government wouldn't get any tax off of it, would they? Well, that's not good for government. I think that's why they'd probably outlaw such a thing, don't you? Not because we're interested primarily in saving fuel, conserving fuel, or solving the energy crisis, but I think that it's money. Now, in looking at this thing of ethanol, listen to this. The New York Board of Trade has now inaugurated, or is going to this year, sugar-derived ethanol future contracts and options. Ethanol has come of age, and once considered an expensive experimental additive to make gasoline burn cleaner and more efficiently, it has become a staple, like soybeans, eggs, and pork bellies. So much so that the New York Board of Trade plans to introduce a futures contract for sugar-derived ethanol on May 7th, and an options contract next week. The Chicago Board of Trade plans to introduce a futures contract for corn-based ethanol later this year. Now, ethanol is an alcohol-based alternative fuel produced by fermenting and distilling starch crops such as corn and sugar, which have been converted into simple sugars. Now, over 60% of the world supply of ethanol is derived from sugar, with Brazil as the industry's leading player. Domestically, ethanol has grown into a $4 to $5 billion industry that is expected to produce more than 3 billion gallons of ethanol this year. That's up from 2.81 billion gallons last year. The commodity is big enough now and important enough in the economy that consumers and producers have come to us and asked us to develop a futures contract for this market. Now, futures trading in ethanol derived in the United States primarily from Midwestern corn could reduce the cost to users through more efficient hedging and pricing. A recent spike in U.S. ethanol demand has triggered price hikes and fluctuations, creating an industry clamor for the futures contract, a tool that could reduce volatility. A future is an exchange-traded contract that requires delivery of a commodity, a bond, or currency at a specified date and price. And unlike a future, an option gives the right without an obligation to buy or sell a contract at a specified price on or before an agreed-upon date. Now, there isn't an existing effective risk management tool for this market, so the buyers and sellers of ethanol are forced to use other tools, Lehman said. The only tool currently available to traders is unleaded gasoline futures contracts traded on the New York Mercantile Exchange, which is considered an imperfect hedge. From an economist's perspective, these types of financial instruments are very important in providing liquidity and transparency in prices, said John Filmy. He's the chief economist for the Washington, D.C.-based American Petroleum Institute, an industry trade group. It's an important addition for buyers and sellers, Filmy said. Now, Bernard Avico, an economist, said farmers would be among the beneficiaries of the first futures contract for ethanol. Farm cooperatives don't have a way to protect themselves from adverse price fluctuations. They don't know what the price of ethanol will be down the road. And it's difficult to plan a business when you don't know what the value of your finished product is going to be. Anthony Campanino, the floor trader, that's the New York floor trader, and senior vice president of East Coast Option Services, said that the introduction of futures contracts was essential. It'll attract some spectacular business, a facet that will help make the market more efficient. Now, if you only have producers and end users trading the risk, you're only sharing the risk between themselves. You certainly want as many players in the market as possible. Demand will increase because of tougher pollution requirements worldwide and continued Middle East turmoil, said Mike McDougall. He's the senior vice president of FEMAT, an international brokerage unit. India, Thailand, and Australia are all starting sugarcane ethanol programs, and they see the success of Brazil, said McDougall, because the additive is in such demand during the summer driving season as a component to make reformulated gasoline required under the Clean Air Act. Motorists in the U.S. also could benefit in the form of lower prices at the pump. Ah, give me a break, would you? Lower prices at the pump? Who are these guys trying to kid, anyway? Maybe they think that we're all suffering from terminal Alzheimer's. Let me tell you a little story here about ethanol that maybe you hadn't heard. Ethanol is not a free market product. It takes more BTUs to produce ethanol than you can get out of it. Well, at least when they first discovered this process called ethanol back in the 70s, it took more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than you could get out of it. So, obviously, it wasn't a very viable fuel, was it? So, there was an additive called MTBE, and it's probably a real bad pollution agent, I don't know, but the government came in and said, well, we've got to have unleaded fuel. See, they used to put lead, when I was a kid, into the fuel in order to raise its octane rating. Well, you know, lead is a polluter, so government came along and said, well, we're going to ban lead. All right, so in order for us to produce the fuel, private industry then has to come in with some kind of an additive, so they came in with MTB or MTBE or something like that. So then one day the environmentalists woke up and said, you know, that MTBE is bad stuff and we don't like that either, so we're going to substitute ethanol for it. Well, they now have, after 30 years, a production technique whereby you can get 1.34 times the amount of energy out of ethanol that you put in. So it takes 1 gallon of ethanol to produce 1.34 gallons of ethanol fuel. Not a very good trade. So it's not a fuel, it's an additive. So we're going to use it as an additive, and of course some big corporations got involved in the program. Congress got involved in the program, and you and I get to pay for it. Now, if you want to know what gasoline actually costs, it's $4.03 a gallon. That's what gasoline costs in the United States. And there's a reason for that. It's just like food. So you go down to the food store and you buy a gallon of mayonnaise and you say to yourself, well, I'd pay $5 for this gallon of mayonnaise, or, you know, a buck and a half for this head of cabbage or something like that. And you say, well, okay, that's the price of it. No, that's not the price of it, because you're not factoring in the price subsidies that go to the farmers. The government puts added costs onto the price of food, and these are called hidden costs. So when a gallon of gasoline costs $1.57 here in the United States at the pump, the real cost to you, the consumer, is $4.03. Now, gasoline, I pointed out last program, is actually a good value here in the United States. We're paying less for gasoline adjusted for inflation today than we were paying back in 1930, 40, or 50. So the concept that we're going to have cheaper prices at the pump is a fool's dream. And that's because there are 8 elements that go into this thing of pricing gasoline. It's political unrest, dwindling supplies, less exploration caused by environmental problems, environmentalists in particular, taxes, population growth, inflation, government regulations, and then there's just plain less oil to find out there. So when we factor these factors in, and then they tell us that we're going to have cheaper fuel, quit kidding yourself. Stand by. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs. And for more information about that, go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, talking about this thing of alternative energy, there's another factor here that we should bring into the discussion, and that is the other side of the energy pool, the opposite side of George Bush and the oil cartel Republicans, is alternative energy. The environmentalists keep telling us that what we've got to do is quit depending upon this foreign oil and the imports coming into the United States, and rely on wind power, solar power, biodiesel, ethanol, things that we can produce here in the United States and wean ourselves away from oil and oil products. Well, that's another dream that isn't going to come to fruition for a whole host and plethora of reasons that we ought to discuss. There are helpful moves that can be made. For instance, President Bush, I noticed the other day, wanted to drill up on the North Slope of Alaska. And the environmentalists and the Democrats just came unhinged. They said, oh my God, there's only 6 billion barrels of oil up there, and we just can't do that. Well, 6 billion barrels of oil is enough to run the United States for 1 year. Now, if you take a look at how much oil is available in the whole world, I've done some programs on this in the past. Just go to Peak Oil, and I think I can give you some of the numbers that go into it. But just in review, there's about 1 trillion barrels of oil, proven reserves in the world today, and the world uses about 30 billion barrels of oil a year. So if you divide 30 into 1,000, you get about a 33-year supply. Now, there's a problem with this 33-year supply of oil, and that is the annual rate of consumption of oil, now worldwide, counting the Japanese and Chinese and Europeans and Americans and everybody in this, grows by about 5% a year. Now, if you take 5% compounded annually, it doubles every 15 years. So if you've got a 33-year supply of oil, and you're using 30 billion barrels of oil today, then 15 years from now, you're going to be using 60 billion barrels of oil. And then 15 years after that, you're going to use 90 billion barrels a year. In fact, it'll be more than that. It'll probably be more like 100 billion plus, because it would be compounded on top of the compounding. I didn't carry it out that far, but then we got to add one more factor to it, and that is the population doubles every 30 years. So if we're going to maintain our standard of living, and we're going to maintain it based upon an oil economy, can you all see that that isn't going to work? But on the other hand, it would seem like to me that drilling in this National Wildlife Refuge would be a logical one-year step for the United States. I want to point out that the United States also has another ace in the hole, and that is the oil shale, which is similar to the oil sands of Canada. Up in Canada, in Alberta province, they have oil tar sands. They call it tar sand. And they've got 1.6 trillion barrels of oil up there. I mean, the Canadians could take care of their oil problems from now on. There's only about 20 or 30 million of them. And then we here in the United States could take care of all of our oil problems for the next, now we only use about 6 or 7 billion barrels a year, 25% of 30. So let's take 30 times 0.25. about 7.5 billion barrels a year. Now, we have 3.7 trillion barrels of oil in the United States locked up in this oil shale. Now, when you talk about producing this oil shale, the environmentalists just come out of the rocks everywhere and they say, oh my God, we can't do that. It'd be an environmental nightmare. And what I'd like to suggest is that all the environmentalists stop using oil in the morning and go home and shut up. They haven't got an answer for the problem, and all they do is piss and moan and bellyache about the problem, and they haven't a logical, rational solution. And if you've heard it, let me know, would you? Now let me just take 3,700, that's 3.7 trillion, that's 3,700, divided by 7.5. And that's a 493-year supply at today's usage in the United States. There's another big advantage to this oil shale, which I concede is never going to happen as long as there's a barrel of oil that can be drawn out of the Arabian sands. But I want to tell you that there is a solution that's available to all of us. A 500-year supply of oil at current production and consumption, well, at current consumption, would give us about a 500-year supply, and we would not be adding to our balance of payments deficit. And you wouldn't have to drill in the Arctic National Refuge. The thing that bothers me the most about these environmentalists is Rush Limbaugh, you know, derides them constantly, you know, by calling them environmental wackos. And I think that that fits the bill. Let me tell you a little story. I was watching PBS the other night, and I noticed that there was a proposal by the Bush administration to drill on the east slope of the Rocky Mountains up in Montana. Well, they got a bunch of environmentalists up there, and they said, oh my God, we can't do that. That's preposterous. And so they put an end to that. Okay, that's fine. If you don't want to drill there, that's great. Okay, well then, where do you want to drill? Let me ask you that. Where do you want to drill? And all I hear from the environmentalists is the same crap that we heard from the radicals at the Democratic Convention back in 1968. What they had in mind was, let's destroy the system. And when you ask them, well, what do you want to replace it with? One of their leaders said, well, we don't know what we're going to replace it with. Let's destroy it first and we'll work on that problem later. That's preposterous insanity. That's anarchy. And the environmentalists as a group are proposing anarchy. They haven't got a solution for what do you need to do? Somebody comes along and says, well, what we need is solar power. Oh, no, you don't. You can't afford that. It costs too much. Well, then what we got to have is wind generation. Well, there's a lot of wind generation going on. If you'll take a look out in the western United States, particularly in California, there's geothermal energy. There's wind energy. And I'm all for geothermal and I'm all for wind energy because every barrel of oil that we don't have to buy outside the country, just like the Japanese discovering or inventing a machine that we could sell to our farmers and let them produce their own oil for their own farms, tax-free, I say is a good idea. Now, of course, our government comes in with government regulation. You know, one of those 8 roadblocks. Remember the 8 roadblocks. Political unrest anywhere in the world is a roadblock to adequate fuel supplies. Dwindling supplies is a roadblock. Every time you burn up a barrel. Conservation's a great idea, and I want these conservationists, these greenies over here, to lead the parade. Park your cars and walk, ride your bicycles, and teach the rest of us how to do that, would you? They piss and moan a lot about these Hummers, you know, running around here. Listen, at $2 a gallon for gasoline, that's only half what the price of gasoline ought to be. You've still got super cheap fuel. fuel needs to be $4 a gallon at the pump to equal the adjusted for inflation rate for gasoline that we were paying in the 1950s. And that's just where reality is at, boys and girls. So we're still in the era of cheap oil. You're not going to get anybody to give up cheap oil until the price goes up. And that's just where reality is at. Furthermore, there's a lot less exploration. For instance, we would like to explore for oil in Montana. And the environmentalists say, no, you can't do that. We would like to explore for oil in Alaska. No, no, we can't do that. Okay, well, where do you want to explore for oil? We don't want you to explore or explore for oil anywhere. Oh, okay. That's not a solution, and that's not an answer. Now, during the election, I just saw some numbers the other day, 60% of the electorate, when they're asked in polls, place the economy as the number one issue that they're concerned about. Well, listen, when the price of oil goes up, or the price of gasoline hits $4 a gallon, you can expect the American economy to go right into instant recession. And you people are going to vote for president based upon who you think is going to lead the American economy. So on the one hand, we're saying we don't want any ripples in our economy. In fact, we want our economy to grow. And we want the price of gasoline to go down. And we don't want to explore for oil and natural gas in the United States. And we don't want to import oil and gas from outside the United States. Well, then what do you want? I mean, come on, let's grow up and get intelligent here. It's time to wake up and smell the coffee. That's not going to happen. Now, it may well be that the policymakers are going to continue to import oil. That's a killer. That isn't going to last very much longer because the American dollar is losing value and nobody in his right mind is taking on any more dollars. People that know what's going on, like Buffett, for instance, or Buffett, is getting rid of dollars and converting his dollars, and so are the Chinese. They're converting their dollars into euros or something that's got some value to it, or something that's not losing value at such a rapid rate. Then you got population growth. You know, the population over the next 30 years is going to double. Well, of course, the global 2000 people want to stop that, but then so far they haven't got that job accomplished, and the population is growing by about 100 million people a year, and those people all want to burn gasoline. Now, when I was a kid, our family during World War II got by on 5 gallons of gasoline per week. That's what our ration card allowed us, 5 gallons a week. Today, Americans burn 3 gallons per person per day. So I think that the environmentalists do have a good point. We could conserve. We could conserve a whole bunch. But listen, when you conserve, that is, when you're not out here buying that gasoline, the people that are selling the gasoline don't make as much money. And then, when you're not burning that gasoline up, running up and down the highways and going out on weekends and skiing and vacationing and so on, then you're not spending money in those vacation resorts, and those people who have a right to expect to make some money off of the economy get hurt. So the reality of your overall economy is you've got to be spending money on gasoline, traveling here and there in order to keep the economy going, because 20% of all of the jobs in America are related to the automobile. One job out of five is related to the automobile. Now, cut back on automobile gasoline consumption, and you're going to cut back on automobile use. And when you cut back on automobile use, you affect one job in five. The American economy cannot stand that kind of a hit. So you're going to have to change your lifestyle, aren't you? Now, how many of you are ready to do that tomorrow morning? That's not going to happen. And anybody with half a brain can see that that is not going to happen. Hey, we've got to take another break here. Now, hang on. We'll be back with more on energy, ethanol, and biodiesel right after this. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, many of the programs or lessons that you hear on the Law Hour are just a small part of my two-week school or basic school on courtroom strategy and procedure, and this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, a summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And then you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, and write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom at trial, either. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, and what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, and how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn them here at the law school in this class. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, just go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about biodiesel. Where does this biodiesel come from, and why should we want to buy it? Why should we want to use it? The daily U.S. production in millions of barrels of oil a day is 5.7 million. Now, that's about 25% of what we consume here in the United States. We use about 135 million gallons of gasoline, or excuse me, 135 billion gallons of gasoline a year here in the United States. Now, that's a bunch. And three-quarters of that is coming from outside of our borders. Now, here's a couple of shockers. Have you ever paid attention to the oil wells over in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Iraq? Well, now think about the oil wells here in the United States. You know those derricks that are out there pumping up and down? They call them grasshoppers and derricks and so on. You ever seen one of those in a picture in Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, and so on? Well, the answer is no, you don't, because they don't pump the oil out of the ground over there. It comes out under pressure. I remember up in Prudhoe Bay, when they first started up there back in the 1960s, 68 or 70, long in there, the oil was coming out of the ground at the rate of 1,600 pounds per square inch. I mean, that's a powerful bunch of pressure. Today, it's down to 300 pounds per square inch. But what that means is that there's never been a barrel of oil pumped out of Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. And over in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and the Middle Eastern oil fields, it comes out of the ground at 1,600 pounds of pressure, and it's been going down over the years, but they're still taking it out under pressure. Now think of this. Oil is selling as recently as this past week at about $50 a barrel. And over in Saudi Arabia, when you poke a hole in the ground, Except for the cost of drilling that oil well, it doesn't cost anything to produce it. Now, there are some costs that are attributable to gasoline or the production of oil. Now, listen to this, and I'm citing now from the National Geographic magazine, June 2004, entitled The End of Cheap Oil. And on page 97, it has a graph here called the real cost of gasoline. So when we take a look at the cost of gasoline at $1.57 a gallon, You put in the state and federal taxes, they average 42.7 cents a gallon. And then the fixed price of the crude oil is 48%, refining is 15%, and the distribution and marketing is 10%. Now, it only costs 25% of that $50 to produce that gallon of gasoline. 25%. So I don't think that we can complain about the price of gasoline and blame Exxon or Mobil or Texaco for the $2 a gallon cost, because they're only charging us 2 bits a gallon. Now, the cost of the crude oil is 48%. 48% of that $1.57. 27% is tax. So the refining, that is the pumping of it from the well to the refinery and delivering it from the refinery to the gas station, is only 25% of that buck and a half. 27%, the government gets paid more than the people that actually produce the oil itself. And then 48% is going over here to the oil cartel, the Saudis or somebody, whoever's charging that $50 a barrel. And that should really motivate people to go out and drill oil wells. But you know, you can't drill oil wells without an environmental impact statement. And that puts us right back in the same dilemma that we were talking about earlier. That's government regulation and the greenies and all these other people getting in the way. If we had a free market, now of course we don't have a free market, we have a controlled market, a controlled central economy, controlled and centralized from Washington, D.C. It's the communist program. And we are now beginning to experience higher prices, shorter supplies, and greater problems in the production, distribution, and consumption of petroleum, which up until recent years has never been a problem in the United States. As long as we left the marketplace alone, we never had a problem with price, supply, or demand. Now we have a problem with price, supply, and demand. And that's because government interferes. And they interfere with taxes, environmental regulations and controls. And there are the natural problems of supply and demand that could be met and could be overcome if we just leave business alone. But we haven't, we don't, and we won't. Now, annual U.S. production of gasoline in millions of gallons, 135 billion gallons a year. Now, ethanol, we produce 2.8 billion gallons. Now, just compare 2.8 billion with 135 billion. Can you see that it's down around 1%? I mean, we're talking about, if we were to shut off all of this oil coming in from overseas and go on to this production, you know, we're going to produce our own in this country, we'd fall on our face in short order. Now, I did a couple of more numbers here for you. We produce about 10 billion, excuse me, I back up here and get my billions mixed up. Yeah, about 10 billion, got it right, bushels of corn per year. And out of all of that corn, if we were to convert all of that corn into ethanol, we could supply approximately, if I got my numbers right here, approximately 10 billion gallons of ethanol, or about 5-7% of the needed fuel in the country. And that's assuming that we never use that corn for anything else but just the ethanol. Now, it's true that you can take the ethanol out and you still have some cattle feed, but my point is, if you're going to use ethanol as fuel, there's another factor in here. It only produces 40% of the energy Let me give you an illustration as to how that works. The first problem that we had with ethanol was that it took more input to produce a gallon of it than you got out of it. It took more BTUs to produce it than you can get out. So they raised that. They got it now to where you can get 1.34 gallons of ethanol for every gallon of fuel that you put into the manufacture of it, but the ethanol only produces 40% of the power that you get from gasoline. So it's a net loser. See, you'd have to burn 2.5 gallons of ethanol to go as far as you could on a gallon of gas. So if you're getting 20 miles to the gallon on a gallon of gasoline, you could only get 8 miles to the gallon on a gallon of ethanol. So you got to use 2.5 gallons of this stuff. That's why I say, you know, these environmentalists, I don't think they've been looking at the numbers. Now, if they've been looking at the numbers, then they're lying to us. Now, if they're just spouting off the top of their heads, then they're not doing their research and they're not thinking. Now, we used to have abundant gasoline supplies, abundant oil supplies in the United States until about 1970. Now, we hit our peak oil production in the 1970 to 73 period. And I used to have an outfit down in Texas that governed that. And so in the 1960s, in order to keep supplies of the Lord, we had our own OPEC here in the United States. And Texas was the biggest producing state in the United States, producing oil and gas. And so when they needed more or they needed to depress the supply, they just open up or shut off the spigots down in Texas. 1970 came, we hit peak oil, and then we had to start importing oil. Now we're importing about 3/4 of the oil that we use here in the United States. And it's been pretty cheap because the oil producing countries of the Middle East primarily have such an abundant supply of it. Now, of course, we have to pay for that with Caterpillar tractors. The theory is they send us oil and we make Caterpillar tractors and automobiles and we send it to them. Over the last 10 years, we haven't been doing that. We've been sending them a lot of IOUs, and these IOUs are going to come due. These people are not going to get paid for all of the oil that they've sent to us so far. I mean, that's just where reality's at. And I'm pretty sure that they all can figure that out. They can do the arithmetic. Now, the energy compact content compared to gasoline or diesel is 66%. Now, there's one bright spot in this equation here, and that's with hydrogen. Hydrogen fuel actually produces about 2.75 times 279% of the energy that it takes to refine it. So if there's a bright spot in the energy or the alternative energy field, it's hydrogen. But right now, the hydrogen's being produced from natural gas. Natural gas is in short supply, and the price of natural gas is going up 27% this winter. 27%. Now, while we're flaming this stuff off, if you've noticed that they've got these big flames out on these platforms out in the Gulf of Mexico and up at Prudhoe Bay, that's natural gas they're flaring off. They've got nothing else to do with it, so they just burn it right there at the well site. Now, they talked about building a gas pipeline from Prudhoe Bay down across Canada to the east coast of the United States, and the environmentalists got on that bandwagon and said, oh my God, we can't have that. No, 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 1,000 times no. So while the price of natural gas is going up 27%, we're not going to build a pipeline, and the environmentalists tell us no. Now, does that make any sense to you? It would seem like to me that we ought to be building as many pipelines and getting as much bang for the buck as we could possibly get, don't you? I think the environmentalists and the politicians, along with the oil companies, are working together to contract supply, not expand it. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit, rather, to the authors and publications that we use on this program. And often we endorse and recommend the books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, the endorsements or recommendations that we give does not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian, or they're racial or ethnic partisans who do not endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. All right, we're talking about alternative energy, mainly biodiesel. I got a letter from a guy, and he said, why don't you do a series on this thing of biodiesel? I said, okay, let's go look it up. I never even heard the term biodiesel. I had heard that there were experiments going on where they were burning vegetable oil, you know, like sunflower oil, canola oil, soybean oil in diesel buses and so on. And they get about 90%. Looking at the chart here, useful information about conventional and alternative fuels in their feedstocks. I'm getting these numbers, by the way, from the National Geographic, The End of Cheap Oil, June 2004, and from a website that gives us information here concerning this thing called biodiesel. I gave you that the last time. I won't burden you with it again, but let's take a look here at hydrogen fuel. This hydrogen fuel now, actually, is being produced from natural gas. Since natural gas is already in short supply and all we're doing is flaring it off at the wellheads, it would seem like to me that the alternative energy advocates and you and I and politicians and everybody ought to be able to see that every BTU that we can use efficiently, economically, whether it's coming from Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, or it's coming from Saudi Arabia or wherever, ought to be used with conservation in mind. Flaring that off at the wellhead just doesn't make any sense to me at all. So I'm not opposed to drilling in the National Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And the environmentalists tell us, oh God, no, it'll besmirch the area and we can't do that. And the oil companies, they say, are going to go in there and tear it up and destroy it. Wait a minute. I agree with the environmentalists that we ought not to go up there and destroy it. After all, God did give us a command and he said, dress and keep the garden. And the history of the oil industry, and indeed many industries throughout history, have shown us that they will pollute the Great Lakes, pollute the rivers, and that they will pollute and besmirch and destroy the ecosystems. I don't deny that. I've observed that also. What I don't understand is, why can't we have both? Why can't we have oil companies with a requirement? Come in here and drill and leave it the way you found it. See how simple that is? Now, we're doing that here in the East. They've got open pit coal mines. And they're doing this up in Alberta. They're taking the oil sands and they're taking the oil out of them and then they're reclaiming it and replanting the areas that are being mined. Now, if we can do that, why don't we? Doesn't it make sense? I disagree with this concept that it's either or. That you're either going to have pristine wilderness or you're going to have oil, but you can't have both pristine wilderness and oil. I don't follow that line of logic at all. I don't believe it for a minute. Now, as long as this oil is coming out of the ground over in Saudi Arabia at virtually $0, the production of it costs nothing. It comes out under pressure. So all they're going to do is take $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, poke a hole in the ground, tap into the reservoir, it comes out under pressure, and all they're going to do is regulate the oil faucet. Whereas here in the United States, there's a little different problem. When we drill a hole in the United States, it isn't under pressure, typically. Now, they used to have gushers, but when those gushers ended, well, then they had to pump it out of the ground. Now, it takes 17% of the oil that we pump out of the ground to pump it out of the ground. So you have an 83% usable return on the amount of oil that you pump out of the ground here in the United States. It's 100% in Saudi Arabia. They get it all. Now, it costs $30 a barrel to produce oil shale here in the United States. Now, that was the number that we got back in the 70s and 80s, 25 years ago. Now, the value of our dollar has depreciated by 50%. So now it's going to cost $60 to pump that out of the ground, or to, in this case, produce it out of the oil shale. But it would employ 3 million people in the process. And the argument that we can't have oil and an ecological balance or an ecology at the same time, I say is nonsense. We've demonstrated that we can, but the oil companies don't want to produce that oil. So the biggest single contributor to the Sierra Club, for instance, is Atlantic Richfield. Now, why would Atlantic Richfield be supporting these ecological environmental wackos? Well, it's money. You see, first of all, back in the 1930s, anybody, George Gordon here in Missouri, if I had the money, I could go drill a hole in my ground and produce an oil well. Well, the oil companies didn't want George Gordon competing, just like the government does not want farmers in North Dakota to compete by producing their own biodiesel oil on their farms. They don't want that. So they put up environmental restrictions. They make laws that ban it. They take the invention and they outlaw it from the United States. Well, the oil companies did the same thing. The oil companies went to Congress and they said, we need environmental regulations. But the oil companies couldn't go there and make that kind of a claim. So they funded and backed the environmental wackos. So they go to Congress and they say, well, we need these regulations. But the money for these environmental wackos comes from the oil industry. So the oil industry and the environmental wackos are in bed together. Now, why do they want to do that? To eliminate competition. You see, today, George Gordon, just like the North Dakota farmer, cannot produce any oil here. I couldn't afford the environmental impact statement. You see, the environmentalists have shut down all exploratory drilling in the United States except for the big oil companies. They're the only ones that can afford to do it. So when we had a free marketplace, we had people out here drilling holes in their backyards and finding oil and pumping it. And when we got environmentally conscious in the United States, we hit peak oil and started importing it. Why do we want to import oil? I mean, just think about it. Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Why do we want to import oil from Saudi Arabia? Well, I don't think that you and I do, but the big oil companies do, because you see, they went over there and signed long-term contracts with the Saudi government and these other governments around the world, and they take 7/8 of the oil and give these governments 1/8 of the oil to develop it. Doesn't sound very fair to me, but that's the way the game is played. Now, just picture yourself. You're running Atlantic Richfield or Exxon, and you're getting oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia for a dollar or two a barrel. Let's be reasonable and say, okay, it costs them a buck or $2 a barrel to produce it. And then some guy like George Gordon comes along and says, you know, what we need is to change that policy and put up trade barriers. Get off this free trade and put up trade barriers so you cannot import Saudi oil, so that you have to develop the oil shale out in Wyoming and Utah, Colorado, and so on, so that we can put 3 million Americans to work doing that, produce all of our own oil and gas for the next 500 years, and make ourselves energy independent. I mean, look, at $60 a barrel, folks, you're going to be spending the same $2 a gallon that you're paying right now. But instead of paying that, and the oil companies, you see, instead of them making the profit from $2 to $50 a barrel, they'd be making the profit from $30 to $50 a barrel. Now picture yourself at this. Would you rather go out and work your tail off to produce a barrel of oil for $30? Or would you rather poke a hole in the ground and sit back and let the oil come out under pressure for a dollar or two a barrel? I mean, you know, you don't have to be an economics wizard to figure that out. And as long as there's a barrel of oil coming out of the ground in Saudi Arabia, there will never be a barrel of oil produced out of the oil shale in Wyoming. It ain't going to happen. And those oil companies are going to lubricate with their bribery. Yeah, that's right. Lubricate with bribery in Washington, D.C., our central economy. Because our economy is now controlled by Congress and the president. So we got ourselves into a pickle. I mean, you can sit back and relax. The environmentalists are controlled by the oil companies. They're working hand in glove with the oil companies and the politicians to keep the price of oil high and to make it go even higher. We're importing this oil, creating a balance of payments trade deficit of $500 billion a year, and there's a reason for that. It's to bankrupt the people of the United States and to merge or meld us into the New World Order. It's a part and parcel with an overall game plan. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. But the next time you get on the bandwagon for the environmentalists, or the next time you get on the bandwagon for Bush or Kerry, just keep in mind that follow the money. Don't pay attention to follow the money. That's what the bottom line is all about. Peak oil is not a problem. Peak oil is not a problem. There's enough physical oil in the world to run the world for the next 100 or 200 years. I mean the whole world for the next 100 or 200 years. Now I'll show you a little bit more about that in the last segment of this series here on biodiesel when we come back tomorrow night. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. And they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in both the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. So for more information, just go to the homeschooling page at the website georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. Well, there's a signal says my time is up. We got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.